Welcome to the Fan Experience Experience with Darren and Mark and a special guest.
Hello and welcome to the Fan Experience Experience, the podcast that explores the power of engagement in football and in other sports. Join me, Mark Bradley, and my co-pilot, Darren Young, as our guests tell us their stories and share what they've learned. In season two of the podcast, we're exploring fan engagement post-COVID, after this horrible pandemic, and we're uncovering new ideas to help your club, your league, or your association to prosper amidst all of the uncertainty as we emerge from this pandemic. But today, the day that we're recording it, is the day that fans return to football. Darren, are Walsall at home this evening?
Yes, but we're in Tier 3, so unfortunately we haven't got any fans tonight.
But like, today's the day though, isn't it? It feels like a turning point.
Yeah, the six EFL clubs have got fans tonight. They've got 2,000 fans, so it is a fairly momentous evening, to be honest. It'll be interesting to see how it all goes.
But as the survey that was put out by the BBC shows, actually quite a significant percentage of fans are actually waiting for the vaccine before they're going to feel confident enough to return.
Yeah, I mean, I don't like to draw too much attention to it, but I think this is, not necessarily the vaccine point, but the general point of that survey, what we've been saying pretty much from the start of this pandemic, which is that the assumption that football fans will just sort of turn back up as soon as stadiums are open in exactly the same numbers might be a little bit wishful thinking, to be honest. And that survey certainly suggests that there's going to be some shortfall.
And certainly, the topic of change is in the air. As you and I advocate to the people that we work with and anyone that wants to listen, we have had an enforced break, and when football clubs are often working, non-stop on getting next week's game on with hardly a chance to sit down and reflect. This enforced hiatus, should have given clubs a real opportunity to think about, what could we do differently? What can we do differently in the future? And of course, an important part of the football match experience is the support that we get from the police. And in this episode, we're going to talk to retired Chief Superintendent Owen West. Now, many of you who follow us on Twitter will probably also follow Owen. Owen, part of the Engage UK project at introducing more progressive and engaging form of policing to football matches and also other crowd settings, got some really interesting thoughts on perhaps how the future match experience might be from the perspective of the involvement or not of the police. So, Owen, it's a delight to have you on the programme. Nice to see you.
Thank you, Mark. Thanks very much indeed. I'm really pleased to join you all.
Oh, well, it's nice to have somebody, from this neck of the woods. I'm sure you'll correct me.
Bradford lad, born and bred, as you know.
Yeah, well, I think you did. Your first beat was exactly where this podcast is being recorded.
Well, it's a troublesome area, Mark. I used to go there a lot. And clearly, things haven't changed.
They haven't, as I nearly actually said, reported instead of recorded just then. The neighbours are often ringing the local constabulary to complain about the noise coming from number 14. But yeah, so you've got a few things in common. And with our producer, Juan, you both studied at Fitzwilliam College in Cambridge and actually only missed each other by a couple of months. That's right too, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I was asked to go as a serving superintendent to go to what's called the Police Executive Programme, which is a degree, a master's in criminology and police management. So I went quite late in life, and whilst juggling, quite a high-pressure job and shifts and everything else, but a really wonderful opportunity, which has really got me into a lot of the thinking and the networks that I sort of currently work with now around what progressive policing might look like around crowds and in particular around football, because that tends to be the majority of the work that we were doing up until we got the virus. Myself and my colleagues were spending a lot of time in the UK, but also abroad in collaborations with colleagues in Sweden and in Switzerland and in Denmark, going around evaluating the policing and security measures for football policing across a range of contexts.
Did you have a big interest in football outside of your job, Owen?
Yes, I did. My brother's a little bit older than I, and Dave is a lifelong Bradford City fan, and Dave was sadly there on the day of the fire as a serving PC and was injured, burnt at that fire. Not severely, I'm really pleased to say, but the enjoyment and the love of the game, I suppose, comes from an older brother who used to take me along, and you know, we're still, well, sorry, again, prior to the virus, Dave and I and my son were still regularly attending at Valley Parade.
So how did this come together, where you got involved with the football policing project? Then how did that come about?
Well, I've always had an interest in public safety policing, or as some of my colleagues call it, public order policing around protests. And I've been involved in a lot of the major public order events in the north of England around English Defence League protests and also anti-Nazi League counter-protests. I was involved with the National Front in 2001 when they came to Bradford, involved in BNP when they came on Bonfire Night, November the 5th, back in the early 2000s. So I've always had an interest in public order, public safety. Yeah. And I was just struck by the changes that had happened within the policing of protest, and why those really important human rights-based changes were not being reflected in the policing of football. Because obviously, it might not feel like it, but policing protest is not that common, even in this day and age. But of course, policing football is. You know, just about every force in the country is going to have some sort of football policing requirement to meet. Yeah. And so there are lots of things that have happened in protest that I think ought to flow across into policing of football. And I was intrigued to find out why that wasn't the case, which got me into a collaboration with couple of long-term collaborators and now friends, actually, Professor Clifford Stott, who is an internationally renowned crowd academic and writes a huge amount on it, and also Dr. Jeff Pearson. And Jeff works a lot in relation to fan culture and the law around public order policing, and particularly the law around as it applies to the policing and sporting events. So, though that sort of collaboration has gone on into a bit more of a structured framework, and we were asked by the EFL to do a two-year project with them to look at the long-term implications around policing and into the future around stewarding and security within grounds. And obviously, we'd started that work, but we're on quite a significant pause now because of the virus.
Yeah, it's interesting because we both kind of operate in parallel worlds, but sometimes so close as to be both sides of the same coin. Because engagement for us is going away from a world that, you know, at a granular level could be illustrated by, you know, either passive or passive aggressive stewarding. You know, that's kind of characterized this world that we want to leave behind. But also the fact that, you know, the aggression that football clubs need on the pitch to succeed actually sometimes infects other parts of the club's operation, with the result that fans receive quite a dismissive approach too. Now, I am speaking maybe 5-10 years past, before you know, moves such as the customer charter, the football task force, and other initiatives have kind of changed things now. You know, we now have the SLO, but I guess in general terms, what we're trying to do with the way that clubs relate to their fans is to move from a kind of coercive era to a progressive era. And that kind of, it seems to parallel yours exactly, doesn't it, in terms of where you're going. So I'm really interested in kind of some of the practical applications of the learning you've done. And in particular, you've done some work in Preston, haven't you?
Yeah, we've worked with Lancashire Police, and we've looked closely. We've been to several matches at Preston to look at their approach with their dedicated football officer, Paul Elliott. And Paul is undoubtedly one of the best in the country because, you know, he understands fan culture. He's a fan himself. He keeps it real. All of his social media engagement is done with a great sense of humour. It's very endearing. It's very engaging. He doesn't preach, he doesn't warn and point the finger. He uses his voice to really great effect around just understanding that you know, if you treat fans with respect and if you work collaboratively with them as opposed to being coercive, as you said earlier on, Mark, then you get a much better response from them. And we've seen, we've worked with a number of forces that are trying to be progressive and are trying to build relationships and reduce the number of officers that they have at football matches. And to come back to Darren's point earlier on, what got me into this, I've talked about the protest side of it. The other thing that got me into it when I first started the research, I looked at my own, as it is now, X-Force, and there's a frightening statistic in there. What I did, Mark, was I looked at every single police officer that was involved in football. So whether it be, a mounted officer, a public order officer, a spotter, somebody involved in communications, or the van sergeant, and basically just counted up if anybody who had been involved in football over three seasons covering West Yorkshire, which is, as you know, Bradford, Leeds and Huddersfield. And unbelievably, over that three-year period, West Yorkshire Police deployed over 18,000 officers to the policing of football in the county.
That's the same number of people as have a season ticket at Bradford City.
Indeed. And just think about the resource that might be available to county lines, to domestic abuse, to knife crime, to burglary, to all of those things. But because of the coercive mindset and the view of, you know, policing still being back in the 1970s and 1980s, that amount of resource is still being fielded up and down the country at football matches. And the Enable work that we've done has taken me to places, and I'm not going to get into sort of naming and shaming in particular forces or clubs, but I've been up a place that's dear to your heart, Mark, and you know, we've seen we've been on briefings there and we've asked the questions and got the data out, and we've seen games there that have got 400, 500 police officers all leave cancelled across the force to police a football match. And my view is, even prior to austerity and certainly after that, that's not sustainable, and it's time that we needed to think afresh about a new approach to policing football in particular.
I was looking at the Enable website, Owen, and I must admit I was quite ignorant, and it was staggering the amount of the costs alone that are attributed to the policing just every season.
That stat that I gave you in West Yorkshire, that came to over £4 million to the taxpayers in West Yorkshire to police football. And I have to say, and the evidence completely bears this out, that very, very often, almost invariably, at the end of these evaluations, our conclusion, and it's not just me, you know, there are a number of academics and fan groups and stakeholders that are involved in the project. Our view is almost consistently that there is consistent over-resourcing of football, that because of issues in relation to reputation of clubs, because of a very poor intelligence system and a very poor risk assessment, we are seeing the systematic over-resourcing of football. And that means, obviously, on the match day experience, you know, people are seeing many more officers than perhaps they ought to be. Quite often those officers can be in a mode of dress which can be quite disconcerting if they're in the flameproof overalls and the NATO helmets or the half and half. They might see dogs there, they might see police horses. On occasion, they might see the helicopter. And what we're trying to do with this work is to try and get colleagues to refocus on the really important elements, the science and evidence-based elements of how to better police crowds.
Well, I was going to go on to that, Owen, because when I was looking at those numbers, there was obviously some key findings that have come out of the original research, and as you've alluded to, too many officers was one of the key ones. But there was one underneath that really jumped out at me, and that was the fact that the officers who were in attendance talked, or too few of them talked to fans. And I thought that was really interesting, and I just wondered what your, you know, if you could take us through that a little bit more as well, because I think that's a thing that could apply to stewards in exactly the same way.
Yeah, it's, I mean, just in terms of what's the evidence for this, just in terms of the methodology, the Enable team is a mixture of officers, quite often serving, sometimes retired, some academics, members of fan groups, and we effectively spend our match days in plain clothes, jeans and t-shirt, and we mix and mingle with the crowd. We might be on the train coming in with them. We'll go into the pubs. If there's a walk up to the ground, we'll be with the fans. But we're not watching what the fans are doing. We are experiencing what it's like to be policed. And so at the end of each of these evaluations, we sit down, we compare our notes. Sometimes, quite often, colleagues have taken photographs of particular things. And so I won't bore you with the details of the methodology, but we have a sort of a consensus view at the end of each match in terms of what's happened. And one of my colleagues, who you'll have come across, I've no doubt, Amanda Jacks, who works for the FSA,
yep,
the fair cop work that she does. One of Amanda's things that she likes to do is to walk around the ground and the environments of the ground, and specifically to your last point, Darren, she likes to see how often police officers engage, even say hi or make eye contact with fans in and around the ground. And quite often Amanda will literally walk up and down near officers just to test to see if any of them are going to actually make eye contact and say hi and just, you know, do a normal thing and be reasonable with them. And in terms of why is that the case? Well, this is where it gets quite deep, but I'll give you my theory. Football officers come together under a deployment, which is called a police support unit, a PSU. And PSU training is all around disorder. It's all around riot, urban disorder, bricks being thrown, petrol being thrown, the need to take junctions, and all the sorts of things that you see when it's going really badly on the TV. Yeah. And that's the sort, when we bring these officers together to train them, we bring them into these units, and we inculcate in them this psychology of almost like a military unit. So to get through this, you're going to have to come together as a disciplined unit, do what the sergeant says, do what the inspector says. And it's very, very high tempo and obviously very, very serious around some of the scenarios. And for me, there's something cognitively in this sort of, when you bring officers together, even for a football match, the fact that you have brought them together in that deployment as a PSU, that you've put them in the back of the van, that's where all of their training has come from around the high-end public order tactics. When we're dealing with, you know, with petrol being thrown and bricks and everything else, obviously we don't talk a great deal in there about engagement and about relationship building. We don't train that in that scenario. So in a sense, it's almost crazy to ask it of the officers that deploy to football. But I think their mindset from that public order training transfers into whatever they're doing, which in this case is public order policing.
I can fully understand that. I mean, you'll understand that in our the core service that we provide for our partners is in delivering detailed, very comprehensive assessments of the fan experience, you know, from a number of different viewpoints. But you know, Darren and I agree on many things, and one of the biggest things we agree on is the fact that the people make the difference. You know, whether it is somebody you speak to over the phone, whether it's the first person you meet when you get to the ground, or a steward you ask a question to, the overall experience in terms of the logistics and the ease of the day might be up and down. But if you get a really proactive, helpful person, it can make all the difference. But we see that kind of cognitive kind of barrier going on, even in some of the most unlikely roles. And I won't name the club, but quite recently, Darren, on one of his European assessments, encountered a mascot that was, I wouldn't say passive aggressive, but definitely passive, you know, and not engaging with people, just kind of stood there, you know. And it's kind of, well, why would you be there if not to walk up to people, you know, pose for selfies with kids to try and make people happy, to bring cheer, you know.
And I think that's a really important point. The way that I look at it when I'm talking to colleagues is around quality and not quantity. Mm-hmm. And too often, colleagues and safety officers here within grounds tend to think that there is greater safety, if you like, greater efficiency for them in having a big number of stewards or a big number of police officers. My view is, I'd rather have the quality than the quantity. And there are police officers out there and there are stewards out there that are worth, frankly, 10 others, because they understand fan culture, they can engage, they can problem solve, they can build relationships, they can, you know, sort all sorts of things out without things getting escalated and turning ugly. And for me, the future to a lot of this is to try and get that type of steward, that type of officer, that is all, you know, a bit more of a natural in terms of how they deal with fans and how they deal with crowds. And where I've seen this to best effect is quite often, almost invariably, been neighbourhood policing officers that are ward officers that are locally engaged, when they are put on football duties, tend to be very, very good at this, because that's their background in terms of engagement and dialogue, and they tend to do really well. And when we do get to enable sort of phase two, what we'll be doing is working a lot more with grounds and with safety officers and with chief execs around the stewarding and security, because it would be silly, wouldn't it, to try and reform and get a progressive policing setup to then hand over to the ground where, as you said earlier on, Mark, you've got people there that you know, are perhaps counterproductive.
Well, Darren and I have worked, you know, with many groups of stewards and match day teams, you know, over the last 10 years. And when you sit down and you talk to groups of stewards, they want to do a great job. There's never an issue with that front. But what happens is things get in the way. And they understand that they are there not just, you know, to keep people safe, but also to contribute to the experience itself. But as often as not, that's not the direction they're getting from their leaders. That's not something they're getting feedback or support or training on. And it's not something that they're being rewarded on either. So actually, when you sit down with them, just by asking them, you know, a couple of questions like, you know, what are you there to try and do? What stops you being able to deliver that? And how could we change it so that it was much more easy for you to do these things? That can often, I mean, I'm sure Darren, you'll agree, won't you? That can yield really good results.
Yeah, and well, as you say, I mean, a lot of the time you're relying on a person to cascade a lot of information down, which, depending on how they do that, could have a completely different impact on the way that fans are looked after on the day. So, you know, I think, you know, it only takes one person who perhaps delivers that message in a slightly different way to change the whole outcome. And I know that some of the work I saw when some of the work we did at Lincoln City, I remember once there was a match versus Grimsby where the initial thought was, don't open the fan zone to Grimsby fans because it will cause lots of trouble and we'll need lots more police and stewards. And actually, going back to Owen's point of a much better approach was to say, let's get the right people in there and not create that confrontation, and actually passed off without any problems at all. But just, Owen, there was one question I really wanted to come back to you, to ask you on when I knew you were coming on the podcast. And that was, I was listening to something about VAR, and this isn't about, the question isn't about VAR, but they were saying that because...
Thank goodness.
Because people have, well, we've only got another 10 minutes, you see, so I think it's too risky. But what they said was, and it was a really interesting point, they said because VAR has obviously caused such controversy and fans have been sitting at home watching it on TV for months now and not in stadiums, that anger and frustration will potentially spill out when they go back into stadiums. And I just wondered what your thinking was on it in terms of going back after COVID. And obviously it's going to be, it almost feels like a very different time that fans are going to be going back into. What's your thinking on the way that the lockdown and the way and the gap, the, you know, the 8 or 9 months that fans haven't been to stadiums, what impact will that have on fans and police, in your opinion?
I don't buy that. I've not seen that you talk about. I don't buy that VAR decisions, when someone sat at home watching it in front of the TV, are going to carry through to, you know, the weeks and months later when they walk back into the ground. I think if anything, fans are going to appreciate what they've had before. I think there's going to be a renewed love and passion for the game. Fans are going to want to go back, but they are going to be very, very responsible and understand that they certainly, until, I think the government was saying, until spring, Easter next year, you know, the world's going to be different. And all the indications are that fans will react really positively and well to that. And just think about what happened over the summer. There was lots of ridiculous controversy around the fact that fans would turn up to training grounds. It didn't happen. There was the neutral venues saga, where it was suggested that because of, you know, potential fan violence and disorder, that games needed to be played at neutral venues, sometimes hundreds of miles away from where the home team were based. And none of that happened. And this constant pathologizing of fans as inherently violent and difficult and causing an issue has been debunked over the period of the virus. So to answer your question, I think fans will go back. They will be appreciative. They will be positive. But actually, they'll want to see some changes and some innovation. So, you know, we could talk perhaps about the alcohol ban, about safe standing. There are lots of positive things that we ought to be thinking about and moving on when we get into the next phase of this. Because if we don't try and look at some of these issues soon, then my fear is that some of the lower league, less well-off clubs are going to go to the wall here. And there's never, ever been a better time to start thinking about the legislative framework, much of which hasn't been reviewed or evaluated for over 30 years now.
I agree.
No, it's a nice positive thing to end on, because, you know, we are speaking to fans all the time from all over Europe, and there is that consensus that people just can't wait to go back and watch a game of football, you know, and there's generally an absence of anything.
Well, just very quickly on that, Mark, if I may, I'm sorry to interrupt. I mean, let's just think about what might that actually look like, and it might be possible in the future to have a drink in your seat and watch the game. Now, perhaps not every single game. There might be some genuinely high-risk matches in there where the police or the club don't want that to happen. But for the majority, why not think about being able to have a drink during the game? That will reduce binge drinking. It will reduce preloading. It will reduce concourse congestion with people queuing to get a drink and then having to stay there. So there's something positive in that. There's something positive about the option for safe standing. That doesn't mean that everybody in the ground has to stand, but for those areas that want a designated safe standing area, that would help with crowd collapse. I know from speaking to people that fans love it, stewards love it, and certainly the police in Scotland that I spoke to at an Old Firm derby liked it as well. And then lastly, just coming back to the enable work, it might be entirely possible to have a new type of football engagement officer, that quality, not quantity, that I spoke about, that knows fan culture, that knows what is normal, that can problem solve, build relationships, and help facilitate a good day and a good fan experience. So I think there are lots of positive things that we can all be doing to give a shot back into the arm for the game.
Yeah, brilliant. I mean, it's a brilliant moment to finish on. And as you were going through there, I was recalling something just the other day that suggested that perhaps, you know, fans would be able to have a drink at the stadium, but if they were seated in the concourse, and myself and our producer could only come up with Elland Road, I think, in the Abbey Stadium. Well, not even that. Their concourse is limited. I think there was one other that we could think of where that's actually a possibility. And again, when you see that the legislators, in inverted commas, don't actually talk like they've been inside the stadium, you know, it doesn't instill us the confidence that you've just done with those eminently sensible recommendations.
Well, you know, the Sporting Events Control of Alcohol Act has not been evaluated. It's not been reviewed for 35 years. Mm. There's no better time now. I get the thing about, you know, you can have a drink, but you've got to be sat down. I mean, it's a bit of a nonsense to me. What are clubs supposed to do? Suddenly introduce seating into the back of concourses, which is going to make people stay longer in an enclosed area, as opposed to being outside in an open-air area.
And it might convert stadiums into pubs, which then are subject to different legislation. But listen, time's ahead of us, I'm afraid, Owen. We've had I don't know about you, Darren, but I'm pretty sure that you'd agree with me that that's been one of the best podcasts we've ever recorded in terms of the value of information.
Yeah. Well, there's lots more to talk about. We could do some more about the legislation and, you know, the sort of stigmatisation of fans and the whole sort of policing strategy and governance. So I hope we can talk again in the future.
Season three is already starting to
fall. So, well, listen, everybody, thanks again. That's it for another episode. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter @FanExperienceCo, at Instagram, which is @FanExperience.co, and via our website at www.FanExperienceCo.com. Stay safe, everyone. Stay positive. The vaccine's coming. We'll see you next time.
The Fan Experience was recorded live. See you next time.